Christmas, stranger.
Hi, I'm Rob Poynton from the Innsmouth Book Club. Join me and my fellow guide, John Chadwick, as we take you on a fortnightly tour of Innsmouth. We visit places such as the Picture House, the Library, and Innsmouth Museum to discuss all aspects of weird fiction, whether it be book, film, music, TV, or art. As well as that, we stop over at the Gilman House to have a chat with a resident guest. That includes authors, artists, musicians, in fact, Lovecraftian creatives of all types. You can find our free shows on Patreon, and there you can also sign up as a patron, which brings you bonus content, plus a monthly PDF copy of Innsmouth News, which features articles, author spotlights, all the latest news and reviews, and more. You can find us at patreon.com/InnsmouthBC. We hope to see you soon, because remember, Innsmouth isn't just a place, it's a state of mind.
You're listening to KZOM.
Gold and the bronze for the listeners.
Okay.
just use the silver in the very beginning.
Welcome to People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos.
Hey everyone, this is me, DB Spitzer, producer and editor of People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos, and one of your co-hosts. To my virtual right, David Heath, Gretchen Brooks, your hosts. How are you doing this week?
I am doing virtually.
Right.
Yeah? Good to hear. Good to hear.
What'd you say, David?
I am doing virtually.
You're doing virtually. I'm doing solid. Yeah,
well,
I'm just going through the work week, you know.
Yeah. So, get up to anything fun in the last few weeks? It's been a little bit of time since we recorded.
I mean, other than just kind of like preparing my house for carpeting and new flooring, I'm really happy about, or apartment or whatever. But yeah, I mean, honestly, I have not been doing a whole lot other than like some Lolita meetups here and there. The zoo's open. The weather's kind of remotely okay right now. Hate to say it.
What is this fun thing, and is it common from the planet that you're on?
All right, I take it things are busy at the farm.
They will. Starting next month is going to be the real, next month we're going to, or in the next 30 to 45 days, we'll have the first babies.
All right. Okay, cool. I just came back from Emerald City Comic Con. I was a vendor. I was there for 5 days.
How was it? Did you have a good time?
It was really good. I had a good time. I saw a lot of stuff, and I never want to be the person with a camera. I mean, I'm a middle-aged person who's not wearing a costume. I don't want to be like, hey, can I get a photo of you guys? And yeah.
Stop traffic, you mean?
What's that?
And like stopping like con traffic because you're trying to get
the trip. I mean, and I was always like really busy trying to get to my booth and talk to people and run around and get stuff done.
Yeah.
But I had a lot of fun. You know, it's like, I don't know if you go to cons and there's like, oh man, you know, I haven't seen anyone dressed like this, or like you're really excited to see someone dressed as like a certain character or see someone represent your favorite fandom in some way.
Yeah, just give them a high five.
Well, you know, when I go there and stuff like that, I always there's always someone who I'm going to be like, oh, wow, that's really cool. I love that. And, you know, I'd been there so long and I was so blasé and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh man, I'm not even like excited to see like people dressed up in Fallout stuff or Cthulhu or something like that. And then the thing that like made me go, oh my God, was Team Rocket from Pokemon. And it like, and it wasn't like they were dressed like amazingly well. It's just that they were dressed like Team Rocket, and I hadn't seen anyone dressed like Team Rocket. I'd seen so many Captain Marvels. I'd seen so many Beetlejuices. I'd seen a bunch of Deadpools. I'd seen so many low keys, and it was fun. But I didn't see anyone dressed as Team Rocket, and I freaked out.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Anyway.
I usually get at cons because I wear Lolita. Like, people will be like, what are you dressed up as? I'm like, myself. This is my clothes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No. People would be like, what are you dressed up as? And I'm like, I guess I just kind of like to dress as a sailor when I go to cons for no reason whatsoever.
You're like a then flapjack. There you go.
Yeah. I mean, it's like all my pants are kind of navy blue. I have a lot of like striped navy tops from various countries just because they're like, I live in the Pacific Northwest. They wick water well. And I think it's funny to then wear a cap and hat on top of that. But, you know.
That's great.
You know what you should do?
What's that?
Is you should make something up and walk away and watch them get to their phones and Google it. Yeah, I'm Barufaka from...
Oh, I gotcha.
I'm an OC.
Aren't you cool? Don't you know about that? They go, yeah. You walk away and then they're Googling it. They hate you.
One thing I did do is anytime there was someone dressed as a character from Fallout, I would say like the random lines that the five lines that like an NPC shop owner says, like,
oh, just, cool.
Yeah, it was fun. They had a laugh.
Well, that's good. It's like your own little cult. It's your secret passwords.
Definitely. But yeah. Didn't see any Conans, but I did see Red Sonja. And yeah.
Did you see the wizard?
Which one?
The Wizard of Oz, because you were in the Emerald City, right?
Oh no. But I did see plenty of wizards.
Kings.
No, but like a million princess bubblegums and a million vampire Marceline. Girl that she knows.
Marceline. Yeah.
And a lot of female Jakes. Yeah.
Oh yeah, Fiona.
And Adventure Time was well represented.
Right on.
Yeah. But yeah. I was like trying to think what was the most popular outfit I saw, and I was like, oh man, there was like so many princess bubblegums. And yeah.
Cool.
I kept daring my vendor buddy, my business partner to say every time Princess Bubblegum went by to say, Princess Bubblegum did nothing wrong, but you know, he's like, why? And I'm like, I don't know, I think it would be funny. I know, like, more like my kids telling me like the myth and the lore of Adventure Time, and I'm like, okay, that sounds pretty fun or interesting. Be like, oh geez, that's awful.
Yeah, like, I kind of fell into it with my young adult child. They basically just showed me all the amazing and terrible things that were happening in that world, and I was like, oh well, I was like, you know what this is based off of, right? Let me just tell you where this comes from. And this is blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh no, I'm that nerd. Let me tell you the lore and the history of this particular, where this thing come from. Oh God, just shoot me now.
Oh yeah. No, I've definitely done that with video games that my kids have turned me on to. But yeah. I don't have a segue for that. But
there's not much of a segue into like this character. For sure.
No, it is, but it's I feel like the movie and the story that our first character that we're talking about, only character really, is two instances of being like kind of like tricked out into like the woods. It's like, yikes, there's some horror there, you know. A folklorist and a folk horror movie. So, you know, a little bit of folk.
Yes.
Yeah. in both stories. So yeah,
true story. Well, not true story.
Are you
story.
Saying that they're a folk tale?
Well, I would say one's a folk horror for sure. You know, people's insecurities about, I don't know, older cultures. What's that?
I got things to say about that, so save that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And Whisperer in the Darkness is kind of the same thing in similar ways, but also in other ways. So, yeah. Yeah, let's start talking about Albert N. Wilmerth. I don't know what N stands for. None of your business is what it might stand for. But yeah.
Not my brain.
Yeah, he's an instructor of literature at Miskatonic University in Arkham, Massachusetts. Maybe you've heard of the place. What do you folks want to tell me about Albert Wilmerth? I mean,
he shows up in two stories.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of
just a sentence.
Yeah,
he's not like a main character though, right? I mean, except he's like a reference character.
Yeah,
like many of Lovecraft's like characters, correct?
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Okay, just making sure, because I've recently read The Whisperer in the Darkness, and then I'm like, does he? He talks about him. I mean, and we talk about the Mountains of Madness because he makes reference to him as well, right?
Oh, I just know that he's in this and Mountains of Madness.
Yeah.
But like, does he have like a speaking part, or is he a background character?
Oh, I think does what's his face just say, oh yeah, no, he says like some stuff happens, and I read about it in the Necronomicon, you know.
Yeah.
Watch out, dude.
That's what some of these characters, unfortunately, so I hate to say this, he's forgettable because of the fact that he's like that, because there's so much happening in the, especially at the Mountains of Madness, where he's like, his character is just kind of a footnote.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Certainly. And in...
And he shows up in the Mountains of Madness literally in one sentence.
What I'm saying. Like, I don't feel like he was like enough of a character that there's a lot to know about Mr. Wilmarth.
No, all we really know about him is that he's a professor of English at Miskatonic University. He's not really a guy. We know that he's like kind of like technically knowledged. He's like, oh, if someone sends me a wax cylinder, I know how to use it. I know as much as anyone else. It's
you definitely want him in your adventuring party.
Yeah. It's like he's kind of a hero. He made the step to go out and get on a train and go and find out what's going on, even though couldn't he just like telephone the police and be like, I'm kind of worried about someone who I've never met and her son.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so he is the protagonist of Whispers.
Yep.
He is. Okay. Maybe, so Whisperer in the Darkness is, okay, I have to think about. Didn't we just recently talk about that, or was that earlier this, like, last year?
I don't know. Last year was, like, a decade ago. So he is the narrator of Whispers of the Dark.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. So that's the one I haven't read in a while. Okay.
Okay.
But you're right.
My apologies.
Oh, at the Mountains of Madness, I went through a PDF today. His name comes up once. And he is the one that the expedition tells the expedition about all the occult things and the Necronomicon.
Yeah.
So he also becomes important in Lumley's work because he starts a secret society that fights the mythos,
mm-hmm.
the Wilmarth Society. So not as a character, but 40 years, 50 years later, his society is still trying to literally, in one case, nuke the mythos.
And something I'm going to say, which may be heretical to some, that is so dumb to try and quantify the mythos in a way that you can fight back against it. It's like fighting back against quantum physics and gravity.
It doesn't work.
That's how I see the Cthulhu mythos.
It doesn't work. To Lovely's defense, it fails.
Yeah.
So Wilmarth is, I think, in a lot of ways, a very sort of stereotypical Lovecraftian hero.
Oh yeah.
Who survives because of luck, sure. And he runs away. But yeah, so he's the one that goes to Vermont.
Yep.
And tells the story.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's him. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. There is so many, you guys are impressive in your ability to retain like the differences between who and who at times. Cause some of their names are so similar that I'm like, who?
Yeah. I also have books in Wikipedia and all this other stuff I've compiled over the years, piled in front of me and jammed in my brain. So it's like, oh yeah, Wilmarth, what a wiener. He's the one who went up to Vermont and almost became a brain in a jar. I don't know if they'd want him though, but I don't know. They'd be like, oh yeah, you're so fascinating. Tell us more about the folklore of a planet that we're not going back to anytime soon.
But he seems to be like the good Rolodex character. Like, if I was going to be playing, like, he would be a useful character to have in your party.
Oh, yeah. No. If I was a writer, he seems like a capable character to do stuff and figure his way out of things. Possibly.
And in a writing stance in a role-playing game, he makes an excellent quest giver.
Yep. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
He gets older and well, I'm not going back to Vermont. I'll send these young kids.
Yep.
And it kind of hints to that. So Mountains of Madness is written probably about 6 months after Whispers. It's not published for another six years. Yeah. Whispers is published pretty quickly, but 6 years later, Mountain of Madness gets published. And so I think that might have kind of been Lovecraft's idea, is that Wilmarth doesn't want to get locked in Arkham Asylum.
Yeah.
But he knows these people are going to Antarctica. He knows what they're going to see. So he bombards them with this as folklore, academically, in an attempt to behind the scenes prepare them. Now, because so little, and that's kind of what people like Lumley and Fritz Lieber kind of bring out of the character. I think Sandy Peterson, you know, too. But because Lovecraft only dedicates a sentence to him in the Mountains of Madness, Lovecraft doesn't say it. So it's kind of extrapolated there.
Gotcha. Yeah, no. One thing I wanted to say is Wilmarth also went up against the Mego, which. If he had to deal with anything in this story, it was the Mego, which luckily he didn't have to. But if he had to, that's like one of the easiest things, maybe except ghouls, to fight. I mean, all you need is a good shovel. Those things go down like kindling.
Okay, we read Whisper in the Darkness for the Mego episode. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
But .. and this is controversial. Maybe he went up against something bigger.
Yeah.
A lot of people, I'm not necessarily one of them, when he comes and he talks to the Ackley, you know, kind of like Edgar in Men in Black, who's wearing this skin suit. You know, when I read it, I think that it's another Mego. A lot of people think it might have been Narlothotep. But he might have been standing in the same room with the big bad.
Yeah. I think that makes sense, maybe from a way that one plays Chaosium's Call of Cthulhu role-playing game, but as a reader, I kind of got that it was Amigo or some mechanoid that they'd created to move around the mouth and the hands, or at least the hands, kind of.
Totally got an Egger suit in my head now. I'm just saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Like all ill-fitting and like it was a suit and it looked like Egger. What?
Yeah.
It was an Egger suit.
Oh, yeah. So Whisperer in Darkness. All right.
Now, there is a version that I have not seen. And can we give spoilers?
Sure.
Where he doesn't make it out alive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, that would be the HPL Historical Society's rendition of Whisperer in Darkness.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It has a third act.
Yeah. So it ends a little bit differently in my head canon in an alternate universe. I see him in a separate universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's fun. So if you can find a copy of it or watch it somewhere, I highly recommend it. It's a fun color talkie, or no, I mean,
what?
I think there might be. It's a black and white talkie. Black and white talkie. There's no color in it whatsoever. but it is the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society's. So it's you know, got those guys in it.
Probably can find it on YouTube.
What's that?
YouTube, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. But yeah, Whisper in Darkness. Let's see. Wilmerth. All right. Yeah. All right. Got it all. Can't think of anything else to talk about this guy. Something I can. What's up?
Yeah, that's it. It's just, I mean, he's the main character in one story and a throwaway line and a plot device and a few others.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So. Up next, we're going to be talking about the 1973. I hope it was both the 73 one you guys watched. The Wicker Man.
I have not seen the Nick Cage version.
It's a treat.
I've just seen the memes and the bees.
Despite the fact that I think it was written by Neil Butte, who is a pretty good writer, but I've heard, yeah, I'm not.
Yeah, it's just some unfortunate choices were made and some overacting happened, and you know, Nicolas Cage, sometimes he like does some things and stuff.
Yep. All right. Well, we'll talk about that after this break.
In Legacy Door, a lurker from space casts a shadow over time.
We opened our eyes upon the human world. We found ourselves lying on an especially yielding bed in a room displaying scattered relics of their shallow past, tied together by more recently produced items meant to blend with the relics. Typical.
A sensitive journalist dreams of unknown lives.
It seems like every time I close my eyes, they get stronger. I can't even say the last time I had a normal sleep, let alone a dreamless one.
An outspoken lawyer defends the suspect in an unspeakable crime.
And that client was Jonathan Strauss, held for the murder of his daughter Abigail and her companion Harrison Reese.
And a stalwart investigator tries to drag it all into the light.
Some of the Reeses and the Strausses have been involved with something that seems to include an obsession with bloodlines and longevity for at least decades.
Legacy Door is a weekly cosmic horror mystery podcast. An ensemble of actors tell a story, also available in paperback, Kindle, and audiobook.
available now.
Moving on to the next part, just to remind everyone, if you like what you're hearing, like this episode, share it with people, subscribe to the podcast, find us on Facebook, we're under People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. We're on Twitter. I don't really check Twitter, so it's just kind of the automatic feed if you just want to listen to us on Twitter for some reason. You can find us on any place, any podcatchers that are out there. Of course, Facebook, Instagram, and of course, the YouTube, where this episode will be. And yeah.
This bottle showed us a path they saw. This bottle showed us a path they saw. Yeah. Dave and D, be angry to go to the movies. Hopefully next week we'll have a real theme song.
Hey everyone, we are back. We're talking about the Wicker Man. And again, not the 2006 film, but we are talking about the 1973 folk kill horror. Gretchen, who's in it?
Oh my gosh.
Edward Woodward?
Yeah, I was going to say. I think this is Dave's pick, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, this is Dave's pick. I was thinking it was yours for some reason.
No.
So I have to give you some little bit of backing.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was educated to hate this movie.
Oh.
At UCLA. I had a class, and this is my first experience with the movie. I had a class. It was called Druids in Fact and Fiction. And it was taught by Dr. Jones. Who in the late 80s, early 90s, she would occasionally be a talking head on History Channel shows back before they were all about aliens.
Okay.
And we had, so this is the first time my experience with it. And she said, the thing we had to point out that was going to be on the test, we had to pull all the reasons why this movie did not represent paganism and English folklore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was our assignment. So for decades, I had this as a bad movie and literally as a dangerous movie. And then I finally go, well, you know, I don't expect the Millennium Falcon and the Enterprise to be what spaceships look like. Mm-hmm, it's some fiction. So, you know, literally probably two decades later, I finally sat down and watched this as the movie itself. Mm-hmm. Not with this idea that I'm going to be tested on everything wrong with this movie.
Gotcha.
So it's a lot more enjoyable if you're not going to be tested on it.
I've always loved this film. I mean, I had the opposite thing where I was built into like loving this because of its imagery and love Christopher Lee being, you know, amazing in it. And, it's just, I've always been drawn to that kind of, that folk horror vibe, even as a little kid, like fairies and things like that. And like the dark side of things like that. And I don't know, I don't really have anything profound to say about it other than, I mean, the Wicker Man it seems like a satanic panic for the late 70s, early 70s. People were kind of afraid of New Ageism and things like that. And there was a resurgence of paganism and whatnot across the entire country, dealing with like everything from like the Manson family people to Aleister Crowley and things like that. So this film is kind of those kids, this was what could happen kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And look what happened to this innocent man who comes across these deviants, you know.
Mm-hmm,
it is totally a satanic panic vibe, at least for me.
Oh, yeah. Guys? Yeah. For me, totally. I first ran across this going to one of my coworkers when I lived in Eugene, Oregon. So this is a film I got to hang out and watch with a bunch of goth pagans, practicing pagans who were goths. And I was like, oh my God, this is like watching The Exorcist, but for like Anglicans or something. This is British people afraid of druids. Oh my God, this is awesome. But yeah, no, I really always thought it was kind of like a cool, fun film. And then I'm like, oh, this scares some people. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's up there with people's like, people are so afraid of, we're so afraid of this film, like in the same vein that they're afraid of The Exorcist, which I'm like, how?
Yeah.
I mean, there's terrifying imagery and yes, being burned to death. I mean, spoiler alert. It's just, but what I love about this film in general, besides its beauty and its like horror and its authenticity in the sense of the characters are reacting to one another, like everybody's doing a good job. Like it feels, I can feel the tension and the terror. I love what this film did for horror as it is today.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I mean, we wouldn't have things like, Ari Aster's film, Midsommar. We wouldn't have that. We wouldn't have like that resurgence of late 70s Hammer horror, like style ones of dealing with like witches and things like that. We wouldn't have that from without this film, right?
Yeah. Definitely. I feel like this is one of those things that definitely is kind of a domino effect. And it's kind of a resurgence in folk horror where others had tried and failed. 1971, the Dunwich Horror. I mean, that's kind of folk horror-y, but this is like, I don't know. I feel like this is a little bit better. I really like this movie.
Well, I definitely think it's a better movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but yeah, no, it's like folk horror is a really cool thing, and I feel like more people don't like kind of get on with it because of the fact that I don't know, they think it's hard or something like that. I don't know if it's hard or not, but it definitely looks cheaper to produce. There's no aliens. Maybe you have a guy with a chainsaw or something, but like, you know, it's the locals, it's the woods. You just go somewhere and film it.
And I think part of it, and you know, this would be a wonderful question to maybe ask Sarah Walker. But I think part of it is kind of like the same reason I don't write cyberpunk.
Yeah.
I'm afraid to get the computer part wrong. And I think that because of some of the backlash from both the Christians and the pagans of this, that there may be some writers that are afraid to use the background. Yeah. And one other thing, and I'm going off on a bit of a tangent, one other thing that I did learn in that class, we don't really know what the English pagans did.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
And what we think the English, a lot of this, and a lot of our idea of, you know, English folk traditions come from the Golden Bough. Great book. Fraser did an incredible job. But I learned that anthropologists hate the Golden Bough because it sold almost as much as the Bible in England in the, you know, the 1920s. So anthropologists would go to these cities of England, you know, these rural areas in England, and they would say, yeah, my great-grandfather said this, and it would almost be exactly what it said, word for word, what the Golden Bough said. And so there's this lot of question, is this actual folklore, or is this people parroting Fraser, you know, three decades later?
I think it's
people parroting probably Frasier, because based on, well, just like we think about Nordic stuff, right? So Nordic stuff is all based off of like monks' interpretations of like Viking culture, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like, I feel like all the, we just don't have this record. We have like, we can do what they call it. My spouse was talking about this the other day. It's, anthropological practice or something like that, and like pretending essentially, or seeing by what would actually work for that time period or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't know enough terminology for this, but yeah, my spouse is a Viking reenactor.
I get what you're talking about. Yeah. Oh, cool. I forget about that. I think you've mentioned that before. Yeah.
So I have a trivia fact.
Oh yeah.
Cool. So, Edward Woodward, you know, spoiler, he gets stuff in the Wicker Man, and it has all these animals. Well, stuck above him is this goat who panicked urinated all over him.
Oh, gracious!
And of all these things about this movie that might be hard to buy. The fact that Edward Woodward, who is in his 40s when they filmed this, is supposed to be 26.
Oh.
No kidding.
Yeah.
He's supposed to be 26?
I think that there's a line out there. And so there's a cut version. The version that I've seen most is actually cut by Roger Corman had the original English version. And then I think his producers or somebody or his backers made him cut like 13 minutes off of it. So a good portion of the part where he's in the mainland is cut out of the movie.
Yeah. Like yeah.
Exposition? Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
I've seen the Corman cut.
Yeah. But one part that Woodward did actually put in is when he's singing the 23rd Psalms.
Oh, yeah.
He came up with that part at the end.
Okay.
Huh. Oh, apparently there was an Anchor Bay release that apparently has the extended version with the chronological order put in place.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, cool.
So do we think it's a satanic panic thing?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's okay. It's like a druidic panic thing, but yeah.
So I'm going to slightly modify that.
Yeah.
And part of this is because of that class. I think it's a satanic panic precursor.
Sure.
True story.
Now the guy who did the movie, he actually bases this, and there's a big debate between the two writers on a novel called The Ritual, I believe.
Yeah, Ritual.
And I don't think that they thought, I think they were, both of these writers, I think, were just trying to write a story. And I think that's one of the things that Dr. Jones was trying to stress. And I took this class in 92. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in LA, where, you know, they were finally going, I can't believe we did all these crazy things with the McMartin preschool trial. And I think that's what Dr. Jones was trying to stress, that shows like this, which I love, fed into it, but that wasn't their intent.
Yeah. That it made pagan people look bad and painted them ugly and like murderous and that kind of thing and slovenly.
And I think that was the point in our class.
That makes sense.
That's what Dr. Jones was trying to introduce. But Dr. Jones also gave me a C+, and I think I should have gotten at least a B+ for that class. But That's besides the point.
Well, and they don't need to like paint. They didn't need to paint this as a bad film because it's actually one of the most like considered one of the upper beautiful films. Like the there was someone quoted calling it like the Citizen Kane of horror films. It's like, come on.
I wouldn't go that far.
I wouldn't go that far, but just saying it's well lauded.
It's visually stunning. I think they took that final scene like pretty much like one take.
Yeah,
and so I think the photography is amazing.
Definitely. And I want to argue that Citizen Kane and Wicker Man are great films on their own. Citizen Kane being like what you hold up and weigh things against is so dumb. It's like the amount that you have to know about various time periods and industries to think Citizen Kane is amazing. Is amazing. And like Wicker Man, you have to either I feel like there's a certain amount of stuff you have to know or accept to enjoy Wicker Man. And it's like pomegranates and dragon fruit, you know? It's so vastly different. But that's me talking about how everyone compares everything.
Like rubber bands and tape.
It's like
those are random things.
It's like a cop getting stuck into a burning wicker person and the life of a news publisher.
I was gonna say it's like a sled and a hand of glory.
Oh, geez, yeah.
Oh, Lord.
All right. Anything else?
so real quickly, though, so the Hand of Glory, just for people who don't know, is a mythical, magical item that is a candle made out of a hanged criminal's hand. Yeah. And the belief is if you light it, it's going to allow you to be able to break into people's houses. And, and Huey thinks that that's his access into the cult. When he hits the guy over the head with the Hand of Glory and puts on the disguise. So it is what allows him to, he thinks, break into the ceremony. Okay, I promise I won't. Okay, I'm going up shallow. I've gone a little too deep there.
No, that's cool. All right. Yeah, and honestly, this is a final episode of season 18. We'll be starting season 19 in early March, early mid-March. So, yeah, keep an ear out for that. And we're going to be posting all kinds of backlogged episodes and also Dave's awesome, cool midweek show, Geeky Crossroads with David Heath. So, yeah.
Oh, and look forward to more updates to our Instagram.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Sorry, somebody's been a slacker.
No problem. All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening and checking us out. Remember, if you're just listening for fun right now and you haven't subscribed, check us out on Facebook. Check us out on Instagram. Check us out everywhere you can. We're People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. You can, you know, drink straight from the faucet. Go to podbean.com. Podbean, as in a thing that grows on a bean pole. Yeah, podbean.com and search for Cthulhu. You're going to find us. Or search for PGTTCM anywhere you can. You'll find us eventually. All right. Thank you again, everyone. And we'll see you next season. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
So, Emily, get this me eggs. Look me.